This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Coping with hate. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
In the wake of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, how do Americans begin to manage and respond?
On the tech front, we're holding on to our smartphones longer than ever. Here are the three main reasons why.
Ahead of a big college football game this weekend between teams in the top four, an Alabama fan trolls LSU, but for a good cause.
And how and why we stereotype perfect strangers.
Even the most open-minded of us, the people, you know, those of us who feel that we really don't have any external, you know, bias or open bias. We have these very internal ways we approach people.
Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein on addressing unconscious bias. She's here in about 25 minutes. In the wake of the synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh that left 11 people dead, the country mourns not only the lives lost, but also the loss of humanity in a sea of hate. Where do we go from here? We're joined now by Branch Isolay, educator, also author of a book called Breaking Free. Branch, how do you see it?
Hatred is an everyday occurrence, an every week occurrence now in our country, which is really a shame. And what can we do to stop it? That's the big question. I think the one thing we can do, though, to try to understand it is how we respond. You know, it doesn't do us any good to come back angrier than we were or more frustrated once an attack or a tragedy has happened. All we can do is look for solutions, and solutions never come in the form of indifference.
When we started talking about this at the beginning, we talked about the amount of hate we're seeing now. Are we more hateful today, or do we just have more avenues to air it, like social media?
I think the second. I don't think we're any more hateful. Hate has been with us since the beginning of time. You know, for a long time, especially in this country, hate and its actions were sort of behind closed doors in most cases. And the people who were most hurt were those that the attacker or the abuser said that he loved the most. Now we're in a situation where hate has spilled out into our streets. And it's, you know, weaponized. So the hate is not, I don't think, is any better or any worse than it's ever been. Okay. But it's certainly more prevalent.
Right. What are the individual things we can do to help stem the tide, I guess, or ease some of the pain?
In most of my books, I talk about spiritual grounding. And I think this is one of the things that we can do as individuals, we can do it as families, and we can do it as communities. And that is, we have to trust in something or someone greater than ourselves. And we have to get grounded spiritually so that when we respond to these kind of incidents, as crazy as it sounds, we respond with love and forgiveness. I mean, these are people who are perpetrating heinous crimes, but, you know, a lot of times the hater hates himself more than he hates the victims, and he's lashing out. We just happen to be the targets of those actions. I always suggest to my family and my friends, you know, we have to come from a place of love. As hard as that sounds, and as difficult as that is to do, without forgiveness, there will be no healing that can take place within us. And if it doesn't change within us, then we just contribute to the ongoing problem. Mm. And we can't do that anymore.
We're speaking with Branch Isolay, educator, also author of a book called Breaking Free. We're talking about coping with hatred in our communities. What are the origins here? Does that really come from a home? Is hatred learned in the home? Could it possibly be in your genes?
Well, I'm not sure that it's in your genes, but it can certainly be in your home. You know, hatred boils up from things like prejudice and envy and greed. And a lot of the things that we grow up with as children, those are our first influences. Our parents are the ones who we admire the most, so they're the ones that we copy as young children. And if we live in a hate-filled home, there's a pretty good chance that, you know, that's going to be our outlook on the world. As we grow, as we develop, if we are not one of the ones who's sort of outgoing and socialized, if we're introverted, if we're rejected, if we feel a lot of dejection, then there's a lot of anger and frustration that may be boiling up inside, and it can come out, you know, in a variety of different ways, a lot of them the kind of negative that we're seeing today.
Could the incident in Pittsburgh be a watershed moment, or have we missed too many of these opportunities already?
Wow, what a great question. I don't know that it is a watershed moment, but I don't know that it's not. The problem that I see is hate is not the problem. It's the symptom of the problem. And each one of these incidents, we believe, is going to be the one that's going to make, you know, a difference and move the powers to be and the legislatures to act upon the methodology of violence. And I just think that we've almost become so desensitized by all of the media and, you know, all the violence that we see as an everyday part of life, that I don't know that we can have any more watershed moments.
Thanks, Branch. Branch Isolé, educator and also author of a book called Breaking Free. It's 13 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
So where are you from? Heaven?
Yeah, I'm a ghost. I died 15 years ago. Like that pickup line.
Hey-o.
Know where that's from? There's a new national awareness campaign that's out focused on ovarian cancer, specifically its recurrence. Part of the Not On My Watch campaign includes a PSA directed by actress Kobe Smulders, who you may know from TV shows like that one, How I Met Your Mother, where she plays the character of Robin Scherbatsky. She's also Maria Hill on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Kobe, what's your message?
We're trying to empower women who have recurrent ovarian cancer to no longer watch and wait. I want women to take a more proactive stance with their health care, to educate themselves on all treatment options. I was diagnosed myself with ovarian cancer when I was just 25 years old, and I was very proactive in terms of educating myself on all of my treatment options, and this was 11 years ago. Now there's so many more available for women who are have the same diagnosis. So we have shot this wonderful PSA, which you can see on the Not On My Watch website, and in fact, if you watch it and share it, Tesoro is going to donate $5 to ovarian cancer patient organizations, so we're very excited about that. But we're trying to create awareness about ovarian cancer to bring it into conversation. You know, it is a disease that, if detected early, you can beat it, like I did, but yeah. I'm a very rare case. You know, 85% of women who have advanced ovarian cancer have a recurrence. Well, and that's just not okay, in my opinion. We need to give women more options, and we need to give women some faith. And I'm excited to be here as a survivor to start this conversation and bring some more awareness.
You use a scary word there, in recurrence. How do you cope with that, knowing that you've already survived it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I live in fear of it coming back. I think when you go through something like that and you're tested in that way, it is, you're always going to have fear that something's going to come back, that you're going to get sick again. So I'm very vigilant in terms of my health care, in terms of, you know, getting a yearly checkup, doing what I have to do to keep myself healthy. But it certainly is a scary thing, and it's something that a lot of women who are dealing with ovarian cancer have to deal with all the time.
Yeah. We're speaking with actress Kobe Smulders. You know her from How I Met Your Mother and shows like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. She's part of an ovarian cancer awareness campaign called Not On My Watch. She herself was diagnosed at the age of 25, 11 years ago. If the internet is correct, I saw that you have a couple of kids. Do you have open conversations with them about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important for girls, especially young girls, to understand their bodies and understand all of their, any, to educate themselves on how their bodies work and what the risks are. in terms of illness and disease without terrifying them.
Yeah.
But, you know, my kids are still young, and it's about really just being healthy, about taking care of your body. I think that there's also, like, there's a connection in terms of really listening to your body. With ovarian cancer, there isn't a screening. You know, you can't, it's not like breast cancer. You can't go get a mammogram. This is something that you have to be intuitive about.
Thanks, Kobe. That is actress Kobe Smulders. It's 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. We hold attitudes or stereotypes about people subconsciously. These may be different from the ones we have intentionally, and like it or not, they may influence our behavior. Here's how to deal with them from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
All of us, even the most well-meaning and open-minded, have some type of implicit or unconscious biases. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal has written about our biases and how they affect our behavior and joins us now. Elizabeth, what are some examples of how we view strangers, even when we think we're not viewing them?
So as you said, even the most open-minded of us, the people, you know, those of us who feel that we really don't have any external, you know, bias or open bias, we have these very internal ways we approach people. So one example that I feel that is probably fairly universal, we don't think about ever, is if you're, say, at a restaurant, maybe say a sushi restaurant, and a waiter brings you your food, you are very happy about your food, but a few minutes later you want to order something else, you look around, you can't recognize which waiter is yours because they may have a different, it could be a different race. So that's a classic one. Another one is if you're walking down a street at night and you see a group of black teenagers, do you bristle that way? So do you get on a plane and the pilot's a woman, and for a split second you're a little surprised, whoa, that's a woman. These are all implicit biases, unconscious biases. And the really odd thing about the research is these are not just the biases of white people. Many people, women are sometimes biased against women. Women may still bristle at the female pilot. Blacks, it shows that sometimes they are biased against blacks. It's really odd, this research, or really odd the results of it, but we all have these biases.
Elizabeth, where does this come from? Is it our parents? Is it our community? Sure,
it's part of everything. You can think of it as a habit we form from birth on, that we're taking in, our brain is taking in, even if we're not conscious of it, taking in all the stimuli coming at it. So, whatever our parents are telling us, or even just the way they behave, they may be open-minded people, but the way they may bristle or behave, TV, movies, school, what we're hearing, what we hear from leaders, everything sort of you take in, it's like this sort of noise in the background that we're taking in, and we're forming these, there are associations between certain people and certain things.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Do we know we're doing this?
You know, we can become aware. We probably don't know. You probably don't think about it until maybe I mention these examples, or you know, somebody points it out to you. But another example is, you know, if there's somebody has an odd name, maybe they have an ethnic name, a name you're not familiar with, do you just avoid saying it? And then do you notice that you kind of avoid that person too, because you gotta stumble on the name, that's embarrassing. So these are ways that we can become, we can start to notice them.
Elizabeth, how do we change our mindset?
You know, so one way to do it is maybe do a self-audit. You can, first of all, there's a test, the implicit bias test. You can take it online. It's free. It's administered by Harvard. So you can go online and take that test. There's a number of them. You can take the race one. You can take the gender one. One for, you know, how you might think about gays subconsciously. All different ones. So you can go and take that, and that'll help you understand, you know, what you might be seeing or feeling deep down. But also, we can do this self-audit. We can really take a look at the types of people that we surround ourselves with. You know, are your friends 90% or 100% just like you? Think like you? Look like you? That kind of thing? Educated like you? You can look at your contact list. Who are the people in business or in my work world I deal with? Again, is it 80% just like you? Are they the same gender as you? Like, that's, again, especially for men, because
because in the workplace it's still easy to have, you know, a lot of primarily male contacts in certain fields. So you can do this self-audit, and then you and Twitter, you look at your social media. Who do I follow? Are these voices just like me? So then you can try to broaden out. You can actively try to broaden out once you see, you know, what your makeup is.
Elizabeth, another suggestion in your story that I thought was interesting was talk to young people. Why?
It's interesting because young people have, you know, they're often more in tune. They're in tune with what's really going on out there, how the world is changing. They're growing up in a world that is really different than the ones we grew up with. So talk to young people. One researcher said, what's young? Young's 10 to 15 years, 15 years younger than you. You know, talk to teenagers, talk to people in their early 20s. But, you know, you could just talk to somebody a generation younger than you, too, will be really helpful. And they can sort of tell you who are their friends? What are they talking about? Somebody wrote me after my article today, and he dismissed it, and he said, oh, I'm going to go back to Victor Victoria, the movie, and have a good laugh. My thought was, hey, you know, that movie's 40 years old almost. You know, you're not really getting a good barometer on this culture and what's going on in our world now if you're going to dig in and get a few laughs from a 40-year-old movie. So you want to try to, it's not just stay current. If you want to understand this world, this current world, young people have a handle on it, so talk to them.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. First full weekend of November. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko. Coming up this half hour, questions to ask yourself in a turbulent stock market. Also, how Instagram made extreme couponers out of us all. Good story from The Ringer. And an Alabama fan trolls LSU for a good cause ahead of their big game. That story in about 20 minutes. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Learn about the best state to start or grow your business at MichiganBusiness.org. Americans are holding onto their smartphones for longer than ever. We're now waiting an average of 2.8 years to upgrade. Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krauss has a look at the reasons why and what it means for the marketplace. Sarah, what's happening?
Part of it is changes to phone contracts that break out the price of the phone versus the cost of the monthly wireless service. Carriers have also become less generous in subsidizing phones, so you, the consumer, are left paying the full price. So folks are sort of looking at that and looking at the cost versus the incremental benefits of having the newest device and deciding to hang on to what they have and make it last a little bit longer. I would also say that there's less differentiation in some of the new smartphones that are coming to the market, which is also playing a role here. You know, back when the iPhone was brand new, for example, it had features that other phones simply didn't have, and that's no longer the case. One analyst that I talked to called it smartphones sort of LTE-enabled pieces of glass. They all basically do the same thing now.
Right. Is there what about the idea of some sort of price point here? Like with these phones, like getting to the upper hundreds, you know, or $1,000 or more, are we scratching our heads and saying, boy, is this really that necessary? I mean, is there any of that going on?
Yeah, there's certainly some of that. Apple's prices, for example, have increasingly ticked up. The iPhone XS Max now costs more than $1,000. And if you think back to the iPhone X, that was $750. The iPhone 7 was starting at $450. So it's sort of steadily crept up over the years. And I think, you know, consumers are looking at what the incremental benefits have been, a longer battery life, a better camera, and saying, do I need that or am I okay with what I have?
So that said, if we're hanging on to these phones longer, does that put a dent in some sales? And therefore, might these phone makers start to, I don't know, turn out cheaper versions or bring back, you know, the contracts or something?
It's definitely a challenge for smartphone makers because, you know, for Apple, for example, the iPhone is responsible for 2/3 of its revenue. So being able to consistently deliver strong sales numbers there is important. You have seen some smartphone makers. Samsung has brought down some of its prices so that they appeal to the more cost-conscious customer. So you see a little bit of bifurcation where some of the smartphone makers are willing to cater to a more price-sensitive consumer, whereas Apple has sort of stuck with its knitting and say we're targeting the premium customer and we'll march steadily upward with our pricing.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krauss about her piece entitled "Upgrade? No Thanks. Americans are sticking with their old phones longer than ever." Does this trend continue?
It looks that way. I will say the next test is 5G, so that's the next sort of faster generation of wireless service. And the test for smartphone makers and really carriers alike is, will consumers pay for the faster service and the associated devices? Because our current devices that we use today will not be compatible with that 5G network. So you will have to make a choice as a consumer to buy a compatible device. It's not clear what that monthly phone bill will be for that network, and not many of the phone manufacturers have yet announced a launch date for those devices, but I would say that's the sort of next test in this, is if consumers are interested enough in the speed gains associated with that to shell out for a new device.
So are there opportunities here for the lesser-known rivals of Apple and Samsung, or for that matter, carriers like Verizon and AT&T?
Potentially. You've had some device makers, LG for one, has announced the launch of their 5G-compatible phone early next year. So you've definitely had some of the sort of smaller device makers try to, you know, get ahead of the trend and be the first to market. Time will tell.
Sarah, Wall Street Journal reporter Sarah Krauss. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Recent market turbulence has been a wake-up call for many investors. Are you feeling queasy? It isn't too late to make portfolio changes. The S&P 500 may be down 9% from its all-time high, but it's still an eye-popping 293% higher since March of 2009. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com has a look at calculations that might spur you to action or help ease your mind. Jonathan, set this up.
Well, the number one question you should ask yourself is, how much cash do you need from your portfolio over the next 5 years? You know, as a rule of thumb, if you've got money invested, you know, you don't want to invest in stocks if you're going to need to spend it over 5 years, because there have been some five-year periods where stocks have lost money. So you look at your portfolio and say, how much cash am I going to need from that portfolio over the next 5 years? You know, and you should have that amount of money out of stocks and sitting in nothing more adventurous than a short-term bond fund or a CD or a money market fund. That way, if this market decline gets a whole lot worse, you know you're still going to be able to meet your financial goals. You're still going to be able to pay for those goals that you have coming up in the next 5 years.
All right. What else to consider?
Well, the next thing that people should start thinking about, and you know, this has really hit home in recent weeks as we've had this roller coaster up and down by stock prices, is what is your freak out point? What is the point below which you don't want your portfolio to fall?
Yeah.
You know, let's just take a number. Say you're looking at your portfolio today, and let's say it's worth $500,000. What's the point at which, if it falls below that level, you're going to freak out? And let's say it's $400,000. If your portfolio dropped below $400,000, that would be the point when you wouldn't be able to sleep at night. You'd be staring at the stock, you know, the Dow during the day, and thinking about selling because the pain is simply too great. Well, what you can do once you know what your freakout point is, what is the point below which you never want your portfolio to fall, is you can use that to guide how much you have invested in stocks. And the way you do that is, you know that in the typical bear market, stocks fall on average 35%. So if you look at the amount you have in stocks, you can say, if I knocked 35% off that amount, where would it leave me? And if it left you below your freakout point, maybe you have too much in stocks.
Interesting. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's a personal finance expert, and he's written a piece entitled "Warning Shot." And these are some questions you should be asking yourself now with this kind of up and down stock market. All right, question three, how much will you save in the years ahead? Explain that.
And this is particularly relevant for people who are still in the workforce and still saving money on a regular basis. for these folks, a declining stock market is actually a huge plus, because if you're regularly saving, that means you can take that new cash and you can put it into stocks at increasingly low prices. And remember, that's the goal here. You want to buy low and sell high. So if you're a regular saver, a falling stock market is a great, is a good deal.
Yeah.
And what the calculation here is to say, all right, you know, let's say I'm 40 years old, and we'll just make up some numbers. Let's say that you earn $100,000 a year, you save 15% of your income, so every year you're saving $15,000. You're going to be retiring in 25 years at age 65. That means for the next 15 years, you're going to be saving $15,000 a year for a total of $375,000. And that effectively is like a huge chunk of cash sitting in your portfolio. So when you look at your portfolio and say, man, you know, my portfolio is getting hammered, look at how much my stocks are falling, you should also say to yourself, hey, I got this $375,000 of cash sitting on the side here that I've yet to invest it. Mm. If anything, I probably have a super conservative portfolio, and I shouldn't be at all unnerved by the market decline. And in fact, I should embrace it because of this chance to buy at cheaper prices.
Thanks, Jonathan. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, again, founder and editor of the website HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend some time with us. The way people are couponing is changing, and as a result, so has the nature of the coupon. Coupons are no longer a static concept limited to a tangible piece of paper. Alyssa Bereznak at The Ringer says they're like shiny Super Mario power coins hidden everywhere among the digital tools we use to function in the modern world. Impossible to resist. Alyssa, set this up.
So there's always been a form of extreme couponing. Maybe you've seen it on a TLC reality TV show, where people stack up multiple coupons and then get a bunch of stuff for free. And that has been amplified because of social media, so that these deals are now going viral really quickly and merchandise is just flying off the shelves. And as a result, people are kind of just all doing this all the time. And maybe you and I do a form of it. You know, we're scanning our emails every day for that discount code. But there is this new couponing community on Instagram that's really intense about it. They take pictures in front of their big hauls of merchandise, and they're doing it for things like toilet paper or toilet bowl cleaner or, you know, Nutri-Grain bars at Winn-Dixie. It's becoming a really amplified community because social media has made it really accessible to a lot of people.
So are stores and manufacturers of these products okay with it?
So stores and manufacturers were pumped at first that things were going viral, like, oh, this is a great promotion. Then they started realizing it was going to affect their bottom line. So things would go viral, and their budgets weren't big enough to account for all these people knowing about a discount.
Wow.
And so they're actually starting to pull back on these deals and sort of switch over to digital stuff that they can take from the internet or remove from an app if it gets too popular.
You made a point in this story, too, about how it follows that the average millennial both celebrates consumerism and struggles to participate in it. How does that tie in here?
Yeah, I think millennials grew up in a time that was really tough economically. Everyone's sort of messed up by student loans and the weak job market as soon as we graduated from college. And at the same time, we grew up in the internet economy where consumption is so built into our everyday lives. You know, ads are everywhere online. You know, the Amazon unboxing culture is prevalent on YouTube to the point where there are now dolls being sold to young children that are just about unboxing things online. That's their personality. So, you know, it's really ingrained into our culture, but at the same time, we might not necessarily be able to afford this kind of consumption. So we've all adopted our own side hustles, and just like Airbnb or Uber, couponing is one of them.
Thanks, Alyssa Bereznak at The Ringer. She also wrote that a handful of new homegrown media outlets like Fabulously Frugal and The Crazy Coupon Lady cropped up to teach cash-strapped Americans during the recession the virtues of Sunday circulars. Jill Cataldo, she writes, frequently referred to as the coupon queen, began writing a weekly column that is now nationally syndicated. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Who needs trash talking when two teams can just have a little billboard battle leading up to their showdown? That's what's happening between fans of number one Alabama and number four LSU before Saturday night's big college football game. It all started a couple of weeks ago during LSU's win over Mississippi State when Tigers linebacker Devin White was ejected on a controversial targeting penalty. He has to sit out the first half of the Alabama game. As part of that, 13 billboards popped up around Birmingham, where the SEC is headquartered, with hashtag Free Devin White written on them. Well, an Alabama fan upped the ante with a billboard trolling LSU that also includes good cause. In Baton Rouge, there is a billboard reading, Tiger fans, before Tua drops half a Benjamin in Death Valley, be sure to donate half a Benjamin to hurricane relief. Roll Tide. Then there's the redcross.org website. According to the accompanying GoFundMe page, this is a way for football fans to donate their money, quote, more intelligently, strategically, and sympathetically. It's a good story from the For the Win blog at USA Today. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.